Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 1st of September 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and our online editor, Phil Bishop. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things with you?
Very well, very well. September already, it seems to be, this year seems to be ticking past pretty quickly.
It's a function of old age. The older we get, the faster it flies.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, what have we got on the agenda today then, Phil?
As always, a packed programme. But let's start off with a recap. Do you remember, I think it was in July, there was something called Net Zero Week. As I said at the time, I don't know who invents these weeks, but it happened.
Yes,
and
we
used that as an excuse to talk about various things, including the challenges faced by the construction industry, particularly with regard to building products, that so many of them are inherently embedded with carbon. But we recognise that a lot of them are doing many things and all that they could to make their products more sustainable, lower carbon and so on. But we also realised that we didn't really have the depth of knowledge that we felt we ought to have. So we said we'd better find an expert and bring them on. So I'm delighted to say that we've got someone who I hope will be able to navigate us through this, the world of hype and greenwash, basically, I hope. And here's Richard Waterhouse from NBS, which used to stand for, I believe, National Building Specification. And I will let him explain what NBS is. He is also a past president of the International Construction Information Society and past chair of British Standards BSB 555 Committee on Building Information Modelling, on BIM. So he's heavily involved in product standards and product specification and so on and so forth. So I believe it's fair to regard him as sort of an independent type of mind on this. I mean, my initial thought was to get someone in from, you know, Lafarge or Cemex or something, but there's always the risk.
They'll have an agenda.
They would say that, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
So let's go straight to him. Richard, thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. How are you doing?
We're all very well. So first of all, a bit of background. NBS, we've all heard of it, we're not entirely sure. Something to do with REBA? What's the story?
Oh, it used to be to do with the RIBA. NBS, it came from the 1960s, when the quality of construction really was seen as being quite poor, and the need for a national building specification to drive up standards of quality and delivery across the industry. And the institutes came together and said this was a great idea. Who's going to do it? And the RIBA stepped forward and said, OK, we'll go for it. So in 1970, they set up the business, and it took 3 years to write the first version of NBS. It was published in 1973. Everybody said it was something that was needed. Nobody bought it. So a couple of years later, the RIBA sold it to the directors at the time, and they moved it from Marylebone High Street in London up to the northeast into Newcastle, just to keep the cost down and ensure that this business could still keep going. And it moved on over time, but it wasn't really until the late 1980s and the CPI initiative, Coordinated Project Information, which linked together product information, specification, bills of quantities and drawings, actually what we almost see now as the first version of BIM. It wasn't until that point when NBS really took off. And now it's used by literally thousands of organisations, architects, engineers, surveyors, but contractors as well, especially subcontractors, with a huge manufacturer base as well. So we've got tens of thousands of construction products. And it's really simple. You decide on one side, what product do you need? And on the other, what products are available? And you've got to try and meet the need with the products that are available. So NBS is It's in the cloud. It has been for a number of years, and it's now all over the world. So we've gone from being a UK-based organisation to being delivering product information, specifications, standards, technical information all over the world. So it's there to help the industry to get what they actually want from their designs.
And presumably it also means that you are able to advise people in these days of carbon reduction, which are the optimum material combinations to choose, presumably.
So NBS never advises, because you've got to be really careful with things like that. What we do is we're about information. We're about getting the right information to the right people at the right time. So if you want to know more about a particular subject, we have this voluminous amount of information on the platform that helps you make the right decision. At early stages in a project, of course, that could just be about the overall design, because one element of reducing carbon in construction is changing the design of buildings so that they operate more efficiently. Then as we get into the technical stages, detailing the requirements, what are the things like supply issues, the manufacturing processes? Where can I go to find more information about those? So we help the specifiers at that point. And then when it gets into construction phase, being able to look and compare products. So if one product has been selected and isn't available, we all know about product shortages just at the moment, then what other comparable products that are the same are equal to the performance of the original, and can I get that accepted by the design team?
Well, you've just made me think that we're probably talking about the wrong subject in terms of sustainability, that the real hot topic in this whole field is exactly what you're talking about, is Grenfell Tower and the fallout from that. But maybe we'll move on to that. Let's stick to our initial agenda first and then maybe go on to that a bit later. But clearly, picking the right product and having the right information has been shown up by the whole Grenfell fallout as a real hot potato. But let's for a minute go back to the whole subject of greenwashing. I'll use that phrase. How much of it goes on?
I think clearly we all know the phrase, so clearly it's going on. Lots of organisations will try and build up their green credentials, but this is where data actually helps us a great deal, because data can allow us to analyse the information that's provided by an organisation, whether that be on design, whether it be clients, whether it be transport organisations, manufacturers. We can actually go and find the information we need and to be able to make comparisons. And we fortunately have lots of standards available to us which say this is how you should display your information so we can compare it. An easy example of that is if we buy white goods nowadays, we see the little stickers on the side that show us what the energy performance of those white goods might be. We have exactly the same in construction. So we can compare different products, for example, and see what their real green performance is, green being in inverted commas, rather than having to make our own judgments.
But do you include in that, for example, air miles from importing something? And are you including the offsetting, the tree planting that someone may do? Or is it absolutely just that the credentials inherent in the product itself?
So we've got three different things in there. So if we start with the product, it's a question of where do we want to measure? The easiest thing to measure is from cradle to gate, i.e. the whole manufacturing process at the point where it would leave a manufacturer's site. And there's a standard for measuring that, looking at life cycle analysis. And that's a really easy one to measure for us. The next stage, how that product gets to site, becomes a little bit more complicated, because at that point we now have to start measuring transportation and logistics. So, and that can be done in lots of different ways. If we look at the Olympics in London, for example, they took a decision they wanted to bring a lot of the products there over water, on barges, because that was a really low carbon way of transporting quite heavy materials. So that's another element that can be measured. And there, when you're talking about choosing a product, you might actually start thinking not just about the performance of the product itself, but where the product is made. and where the site will be to try and find a manufacturer that's close to the site. So that's another element of it. And then we've got the in-use performance, we've got wastage. So, you know, what level of waste is there on site? Would this be better if it was done as an off-site manufacturer? And then, because it's a lot easier to recycle from in a factory, and then deliver a larger component to site, are these options? So we have lots of different elements, and that's why this is quite a complicated area. There are lots of different moving parts depending on which route you want to take.
It's very, very easy to become confused, or even sort of, I suppose, easily misled as well about the environmental performance of a particular product because of all those variable factors that go into its production and delivery. The really carbon intensive materials like cement and steel, presumably there's only a certain amount of mitigation that can go on there. I mean, you know, quarrying limestone, burning it and all the rest of it, it's very difficult to reduce that. But we get some quite surprising claims from manufacturers and suppliers in those sectors about the performance. I mean, for example, concrete mixes which have zero cement in them, things like this, or nearly zero cement. I'm not sure if zero cement is actually possible. Are we being hoodwinked there, or are these some of these claims, do they really stand up to scrutiny?
I think in that area we actually should start believing it is possible. If we look at the production of the materials, it's very rare that you'll find one thing that you can change that will make an enormous difference. We should be looking at the whole process and seeing where can we take elements of carbon from that process. So if we take cement, yes, one element is the actual quarrying, but then there's also, are there ways of in getting the heat into the ovens, can we find that from other sources? Can we find ways of reducing carbon? And the great news there is UK government is actually supporting some of the research initiatives right now to actually be able to do that, to look at how we can reduce those elements. Then there's also looking at how we extract other elements like the lime, what else can be done there. So breaking it down into different parts and identifying small reductions across large areas, then we can actually build that up to become really quite a significant improvement in reducing carbon. And McKinsey have actually done a paper on this, the management consultants, and they believe that we should be able to reduce the carbon in cement by nearly 60%. That it is possible to do that if we wish. And cement is the most carbon intensive product that we have. It equals something like 6-7% of carbon emissions for the world. So it's a great target for us to try and change.
And 60% saving on that is massive, obviously.
It really is. Yeah. Now, that's going to take a long time because at the minute we're looking at those options, how we would do that. But then, of course, you've got to scale that. And scaling that around the world will take time. But I think that's clearly an area where there's a lot of excitement at the minute. There's the same with removing coking from steel production. There's lots of excitement there about how we can find different ways of reducing carbon. So they all look really interesting. The great news for all of us is that there is an intent to do something about this. And construction, as we've already talked about, is one of the most carbon intensive industries in the world. So it's incumbent upon all of us to try and find ways of reducing that. But once again, not looking for the single silver bullet, looking across all of our processes and seeing where can we make those changes, even small ones, that build up to something really quite impressive.
You say we've got a long way to go. How far have we come?
I think, well, one of the measures in the UK is our electricity production, because that looks at efficiency of all of the things in building, because buildings use so much electricity. We're now using less electricity than we used to do in the 1980s. So we're already making huge, huge savings there, but we've got a long, long way to go. And it's not just in construction, it's across all areas. I think we still need more ambition in construction. If we look at the other major contributor, which is the automotive industry, they've now set targets, or government has set targets, to say we will not have internal combustion engines in cars by 2030. So there we go. We've got a 9-year target to transform an industry. What we don't have in construction at the minute is that 9-year target to transform construction. What we've got is individual pieces which are building up to a bigger plan, but it's still being led by the willing as opposed to really forcing the industry to make a change. And there are so many elements that can build up to something bigger, but we don't have that big stick for construction just yet. And I think that would be something that would be great to see.
What would you like that big stick to look like? What do you want the government to come out and say?
I think that's probably one of the reasons why government hasn't come up with it. We're all trying to work out what is that big stick. But I think for me, this can't be evolution. It's got to be revolution. And government is starting to show us that. So things like off-site modular construction, the presumption in favour in the construction playbook, which is a great start. But rather than that being 10 or 20%, let's say that's going to be 70%. Let's say we're going to turn construction into assembly rather than building. Yeah, I'm up in the northeast at the minute. Hadrian's Wall is about a mile away from me just at the moment.
Yeah, but Hadrian's Wall is still standing, and that wasn't built off-site.
This is very true, but it was fantastic engineering. And what they did is they put one stone on top of another to build barracks, and they put underfloor heating in, and they put putlog scaffolding on the outside so they could get up and build the roof. And sure enough, you go and look at housing sites over in the local town a few miles away from me here, they're still building houses the same way.
Maybe that's because they want to last as long as Hadrian's Wall.
not these days. It's sure 60 years will. If you're lucky.
Wouldn't it be great if they did? Because that's another essential element, of course, around carbon in construction. It's about making sure things last, and it's not a disposable economy, it's a disposable industry. Quite often now we see buildings that were built relatively recently being demolished rather than repurposed. You know, there's this old adage, the greenest building is a building that already exists. And repurposing is another element. It's not just about the individual products. It's about our whole approach to the built environment. So there's so many different elements to it.
OK, let's get back onto the product information aspect we're talking about, which will lead us on to the Grenfell aspect. Does NBS ever have to slap product manufacturers, product marketers on the wrist for misleading claims? Or do you have to ever expose them?
NBS, our job isn't to be the police. Our job is to create data structures that allow information to be exchanged very effectively. So we don't audit the manufacturer for all of the things that they do. It's a self-declaration on behalf of the manufacturer, which incidentally is the way that a lot of product information goes into all industries. This is manufacturers saying it. However, NBS has been involved in the Marketing Integrity Group through the Construction Products Association, building the new code for product information. And a draft of that code came out earlier on this year, got a very large, very widely supportive response from the industry. And it's being rolled out at the moment in a trial phase and will be launched later this year. And that marketing integrity is exactly what you said. It's about ensuring that manufacturers are clear and concise in what they say about their products and that they can demonstrate that the information they provide is true. So NBS has been supporting that as an industry initiative rather than an initiative just as NBS.
But even before the code, there's a moral, if not even legal, obligation upon marketers not to lie. Why does signing this code suddenly change things?
Because it will ensure that you can trust the information in the information provided where manufacturers sign up to that code. If manufacturers then are found not to be providing that, they'll be removed from that register. And I think in terms of trust, because we all have to build on trust, If a manufacturer then is not on that register, it is less likely their products will be specified and used. So I think it will create a lever for manufacturers to say, we need to be on that register. We need to be able to demonstrate that what we say is true. And I think it's really clear that over the last few years, that has been exposed as the very dark side of our industry, in the misleading comments and untrue comments and data that has been provided by some, certainly not all, but by some manufacturers. And that has to change. And the new code will be one of the elements of ensuring that that's done effectively. But you're right, it's not just moral, it is legal as well. And I think, you know, the Grenfell inquiry is ongoing. We'll see what comes from that once the inquiry is completed.
The product marketing code, I absolutely understand the rationale. I think the only question about it is, how does it actually make things different? Because there was already a duty there. I'm sure that, you know, you guys at MBS, if you found out that you'd been given duff information, you wouldn't use it. Or misleading information, you wouldn't have left it, used it, and they would have automatically been left off the list of products available. The fact that now they're saying, okay, I may have lied before, but I promise I won't do it again, doesn't actually stop them being liars. If they, you know, once a liar, always a liar, aren't they?
No, because there's a reporting principle within this as well, where people find the information to be incorrect. And one of the things, once again, that's come out of the inquiry is that actually the whistleblowing didn't work effectively previously. This is a way of getting that whistleblowing to work effectively against those manufacturers that do bend the rules or break the rules. And I should say, with MBS, we are in constant contact with manufacturers to check that their information is correct, and for them to actually tell us, yes, this is right. And we do that because not only do we want to make sure that the information is correct and what they're saying is true, but also the product information changes on a regular basis. And we have to make sure that that information is up to date so that the latest information is being pushed into the industry. So MBS obviously goes beyond that, where we're constantly engaging with the manufacturers to get the right information. But it does rely on the manufacturers being clear and correct in terms of what they tell NBS and other organisations that produce information in construction as well. The code, though, will make a difference, because the code of product information will make a difference, because that will start to become a reference source, and NBS uses lots of reference sources, a reference source to say these people are doing the job properly. And if at any point they were found not to, they would be removed. That would be incredibly damaging for a manufacturer not to be on there. So you make sure, if we go back and look at GasSafe for gas engineers, if your gas engineer isn't on the GasSafe register, you won't use them because you can't trust them. You can trust somebody that's on that GasSafe register. The code will do the same thing.
I imagine that the shock of Grenfell and the, for want of a better term, malpractice that it exposed in product specification and marketing will have been felt all the way through the industry. So, I mean, surely it would be a reckless manufacturer that carries on regardless now. I mean, presumably all product manufacturers must be having a good hard look at their product descriptions and their marketing and that kind of thing. So presumably getting them to toe the line when it comes to the code would be easier, because presumably they'll realise it's in their own interest apart from anything else.
I think the Grenfell has taught us so many lessons, and it should do. A tragedy where 72 lives are lost must be a starting point for massive change in the industry. I've talked previously about 1985 and looking over Bradford when a plume of smoke went up and it was Valley Parade, the football ground, on fire. 56 people lost their lives. Hazel, Hillsborough. And what that did, it led to the transformation of football stadia, well, all stadia, actually, in the UK. And that transformed that industry. We now have the world's best football league in the UK. Grenfell has to be the point where change takes place in construction, where transformation takes place in terms of the whole process. And Dame Judith Hackett's report demonstrated and highlighted where she saw the problems. Product information, products availability and use was one of the key areas. And that's leading now to many other things. So we've got the Golden Thread Initiative, which will capture data and decision-making through the both the inception, design, construction, and operation of the building. We've got the whole thing around product safety. So remember, as well as this new code, we've got the new Office of Product Safety and Standards coming in to look at the performance of construction products as well. And then on top of that, we've got all of the competency framework, because it's not just about the product. What we saw from Grenfell was the right product being installed the wrong way. So the competency of all of the people involved in the design and construction process as well, and operation with the building safety managers. All of these things will come together to transform the construction industry. And, you know, Grenfell was awful, just awful. It cannot be repeated. And these pieces will be there to stop that from happening.
You sound pretty optimistic about that.
Yeah, I am an optimist. you have to be. If we don't believe we can change, then we should just get out and find somebody else who can deliver the construction industry in a way that it should be delivered. You're right. You mentioned that all the manufacturers should be looking at their processes, what they do. It's not just the manufacturers. It's the contractors. It's the subcontractors. It's the architects, the engineers. It's the building control. Of course, we're getting a whole new regulator as well in terms of these buildings. So all of these areas, there's nothing untouched in terms of the need for change post-Grenfell. And that change will come. The Building Safety Bill is going through Parliament. It's had a number of readings already. So it will come through Parliament, hopefully this year. The new regulator is already starting to be built. Should be operating effectively next year, and then fully operational on these very high-risk buildings by 2023.
Brilliant. I think that's a good concluding point, Richard, on a positive note.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
That's great. It's great to have you on. So, Phil, what else has been in the news this week?
Well, I was quite interested. Bit of a change of subject here, but just to read about the shortlist for the 2021 Wolfson Economics Prize. This is the Simon Wolfson, Lord Wolfson, the chap who owns the Next retail chain, every year puts up £250,000 as prize money for some big idea that will improve Britain, the economy, whatever. And this year's competition, which was launched back in February, I believe, asked the question, how would you design and plan new hospitals to radically improve patient experiences, clinical outcomes, staff well-being, and integration with wider health and social care? So this is a construction story we can talk about. The shortlist was produced this week, five shortlisted entries. Basically, the initial entry is just a 10,000-word essay. Put all your ideas down. One of these will be picked as the winner later in the year. What's interesting to me is that four of the five are variations on a theme of hospital design, which is sort of what you'd expect, given the nature of the question. An interesting one suggesting that hospitals should be designed like a starfish, which I think more of an airport hub and spoke with a central hub in the middle. And,
or a prison, a panopticon.
Yeah. Yes, it might look a bit like Belmarsh. Mine is that one, I suppose. Another one was it's quite interesting, reimagining emergency departments, a series of airline, first class airline style pods, in individual little areas, which is quite an interesting idea. Another one, which I confess I didn't understand. There's not a huge amount of detail on these ideas. There's only sort of a sentence or two details on these ideas on the Wolfson Prize website. But this one says, a proposal that draws upon neuroscience and the symmetry of shapes found in nature.
Okay.
sounds
fairly
interesting.
Esoteric. Yeah.
Well, there's 10,000 words. Maybe it's fabulous. And sure. Maybe, ladies and gentlemen, we have a winner. But I have no idea on that one. And one which, despite having the input of the fabulously eminent Chris Wise, one of our top structural engineers in this particular entry, he was involved in. But all I could see is the simple idea is to have lots of trees and shrubs everywhere, which is lovely. Trees and shrubs
are
great.
What's not to like?
But I'm not sure that it's worth, you know, £750,000 to come up with the idea of planting some trees. But as you say, what's not to like? But the one that really grabbed my imagination, my attention, and I think potentially has the most impact for the construction and property industry, is something called the well-placed hospital. And the pitch for this is simply bring the hospital back into the town to better serve local communities. And I just thought, well, yes, that makes an awful lot of sense. And along with this, with the prize gave a couple of what they call light bulb awards. I don't know if there's anything more to a light bulb award than a badge, but it wasn't shortlisted. But this is an idea similar to the well-placed hospital proposal, but perhaps move forward a notch. That came from Arup, the consulting engineer, supported by Sheffield Teaching Hospitals, Sheffield City Council and Sheffield Hallam University. What they're proposing is repurposing vacant department stores or major retail stores in cities and towns as outpatient and diagnostic hubs. And the test case they're suggesting is the former Debenham store in the middle of Sheffield. Debenhams, we know, all their stores, I think, certainly most, have closed down now. And we've got these, but it's not just Debenhams, we've got masses of big empty department stores and in the middle of high streets. And wouldn't it be useful to put in those empty places something that we all need and have and find it at the moment very hard to access, which is healthcare? What's particularly interesting is that in my local town, the Laura Ashley in the middle of town shut down a year, 18 months ago, I can't remember exactly when. That is now, and it's right by next door to the House of Fraser department store, it's now an NHS walk-in COVID vaccination centre. And so it's already happening. High street stores are already, I don't know whether it's happening in your town or anyone else's towns, but in my town it's happening. And I just think that's a great idea.
It is. I mean, actually, in our local town, the walk-in vaccination centre is the old leisure centre, which I suppose is on the edge of the town. But again, it's a big, currently more or less empty building. It makes sense to use it for something like that. And there's a lot.
I was going to interrupt there. Richard was just telling us that the greenest building is the existing building.
Precisely. And most of the talk was about turning these old buildings into residential developments. And there are problems with that, because a lot of them tend to have fairly deep, you know, they're fairly deep. You only get natural daylight around the perimeter of them. Right in the middle, there ain't any, and so you've got problems of actually turning these into livable areas. But hospitals are a bit like that, you know. They're big buildings. They don't necessarily have to have natural daylight in every single part of them. So in a way, an old Debenhams or House of Fraser could probably be turned into a healthcare facility quite easily, I would have thought. I mean, there's a lot of mechanical and electrical stuff to do if you're going to have a hospital installed, but I'm sure there'd be potential for that as well.
As long as you can still get the ambulances there.
Well, that's a big thing.
Blocked off by pedestrian zone making or whatever.
Yeah, that is the problem. But I mean, if it's an outpatient facility or something like that, where, you know, it's not going to have an emergency A&E department that could be blocked off by traffic queues in the high street or something like that, then I don't think that's an issue. Because in many towns, of course, there's good public transport networks, so they're actually far more accessible than they would be in an out-of-town hospital where you need to drive yourself there.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think it's a good idea.
I mean, all the new hospitals I can think of, they do tend to be out-of-town developments.
Yes.
And then they often spawn, generate development around them. whether it's house building or other new infrastructure around them. But if you put it within the town centre, maybe it could just help reinvigorate the town centre, and it's nearer where the people are, where the patients are.
Yeah, because the alternative, I mean, if you can't find an alternative use for an empty department store, which is no good for retail anymore, harking back to what Richard was saying earlier, really the only option is to demolish it and build something else in its place. And of course, that's very wasteful, and it's not in the least bit green. So if you can repurpose it, it would be far, far preferable, wouldn't it?
I agree. This is an interesting idea.
Yeah.
I dare say there's a drawback that we haven't considered, but I mean, in the old days, all hospitals used to be, you know, cottage hospitals, these little hospitals in town centres, and then we decided small wasn't beautiful. They all closed, in broad terms, they've all been closed, and these big super hospitals, PFI jobs, with, you know, they can cure every known disease, they've got every expertise in one place, all in one big super hospital. But I'm not sure. I think there's still space for small is beautiful.
So, yeah, well, so we'll find out who's made the cut in November, will we, about this?
Yes.
The Wolfson Economic Prize. Yeah.
And hopefully get a bit more flesh on the bones of designing a hospital based upon neuroscience and the symmetry and shapes found in nature.
Right, yeah. Look forward to that. So anything else caught your eye this week, Phil?
Well, the final thing I wanted to touch on. Do you remember in March, the budget, Rishi Sunak, generated a lot of excitement in the plant sector by announcing a super deduction for capital investment? For every 100 quid you spend buying a piece of machinery, you get a tax credit of £130 back. Now, this sounded like, at the time, a fantastic incentive. Part of it was to stimulate the economy, and part of it was to, you know, sort of post-COVID stimulation, and part of it was to incentivise those companies who are still running old, dirty, polluting, pre-stage 5 or still diesel-powered and trying to get electric upgrades or whatever, but dirty kit, to give them a financial leg up to buy new, cleaner machinery. So win-win all round seemed like a great idea. The Civil Engineering Contractors Association have now come out and said, we want some of this. We don't buy, you know, our members, most of them don't buy machinery, but we still think we should have some taxpayers' money as well, because we want some money, please. They think that because they hire machinery, they should be allowed to get tax breaks for that too, which seems to completely misunderstand the point of this whole incentive and the tax break. And I just thought, for an organisation as usually sharp and on the ball as the Civil Engineering Contractors Association, I was just quite staggered that they could put their arm out for this one.
Well, me too. And I don't know, I have thought about this and done a bit of looking into it, and I think it might be a bit more, there might be more to it than meets the eye. Actually, I looked at the announcement. I read your story on the website. I also looked at the announcement put out by the Civil Engineering Contractors Association. I don't think that their announcement was very clear. I don't think they made it clear what they're actually after, because if they're saying that their members, civil engineering contractors, should be able to benefit from this by getting a super deduction on hiring equipment in from somebody else, then I think that's clearly nonsense. I just don't think that could be countenanced at all. But what I do know is, having found out this morning that several organisations, and of course I won't be able to find out, I won't be able to remember who they are now, several organisations have been calling for the super deduction allowance to be made available to equipment that is leased and hired. Now, the thing is, we actually published something about this in the magazine back in May, I believe, May or July, I cannot even remember.
There was an important detail that in the budget, everyone, you know, people, the Rob Oliver from the Construction Equipment Association, for example, you know, straight after the budget said, "This is fantastic."
Yes.
All our members who make machines, every machine they, you know, it's going to be a big boom in machinery buying. But it emerged about a month later that you just because you bought the machine didn't entitle you to the rebate, the tax allowance. You had to buy the machine and use it yourself.
Yes. Yes, that's right. This is it.
And this was explained in the piece you had in the magazine, your lowdown on on the super deduction.
Well, this was actually written for us by a specialist in the area, actually, Steve Watts, who's a tax partner with the accountancy firm BDO. The idea of the feature was I realised that this was a complex issue, and you could very quickly get bogged down and go round and round in circles trying to figure it out. So we got an expert to try and simplify it for us. One thing that he came up with, which surprised me so much that I had to go back and check with him, was that if you are a contractor or building firm and you buy yourself a backhoe loader for your own use on your projects, then you will qualify, if all the other T's are crossed and I's are dotted, then you will qualify for this super deduction. But if you are a hire company and you buy that backhoe loader to hire out to somebody else, backhoe loader is probably not a good example, say a site dumper or something like that, that you buy to add to your fleet to hire out to somebody else to use on their project, then you won't qualify for that. And in fact, Steve gave us two hypothetical examples, and I'll just read them out for you. Example one is Acme Tower Cranes purchases a fleet of cranes which it hires to GB Construction for use on a major project. Assuming the cranes are new and their purchase was within the relevant time period, Acme Tower Cranes can claim the 130% super deduction on its investment. Now, the reason for that is because Acme Tower Cranes will hire out that machine with an operator. And because it's operated plant, Acme Tower Cranes is not leasing equipment, it is providing a service. Because they're providing a service, then they qualify for the super deduction because they're buying the crane for their own use in order to provide a service to their customers. The other example is A1 Tool Hire buys a fleet of site dumpers that it distributes across its depot network for hire to customers on a day rate. The purchase does not qualify for the super deduction because the equipment is not supplied with an operator, and A1 plant hire is considered hiring or leasing, not providing a service. So there has been actually a drive by not just, I think the Civil Engineering Contractors Association has basically joined the fray here, but organisations like the Finance and Leasing Association and the British Vehicle Rental and Leasing Association, they want the measure to include leasing and plant hire. They want to extend the entitlement to leasing and plant hire. So, I mean, it's
now that I go along with that. If the Construction Plant Hire Association come out and said, our members are buying shed loads of machinery. You know, some of them are hiring it out with an operator, some without an operator. They're both doing the same thing, essentially.
Yeah.
They should both be entitled to the tax relief.
Yes.
That argument I could get behind, absolutely.
Yeah.
Civil engineering contractors, the end user customer. No, if you're not buying machinery, you don't get a machinery buying rebate.
Well, this is why I think that maybe the Civil Engineering Contractors Association has not been clear in the message it's giving. Maybe it's saying that we as customers want our suppliers, the plant hirers, to qualify for this super deduction, presumably because they think that's fair, and their members, civil engineering contractors, use this service. They want their suppliers to be able to get the super deduction so that they can invest in more modern fleet and everybody benefits. But it reads as if they want their members to get the tax breaks, not their suppliers.
It's absolutely what they're saying.
Is it?
And as I say, it should not be the Civil Engineering Contractors Association fighting this fight. It should be the CPA, the Construction Plant Hire
Association. Yeah, and I don't think they've said anything about it, have they? The CPA?
I went on their website to see if they were saying something about it. What it is that 8 a group of trade bodies, including the British Vehicle Rental and Leasing Association and the Association of Chartered Certified Accountants are in here as well, and the Finance and Leasing Association, a group of organisations have got together and collectively written a letter to the Chancellor, to Rishi Sunak, saying you should widen out the terms of the super deduction allowance. And widening it out to leasing, I get if it's to people who buy machinery and equipment for leasing, yes. But widening it to people who actually hire in machines, no.
No.
So the CECA should not be involved. It's nonsense. But what it does highlight is something I've always felt, is that the whole concept of our use of vocabulary, plant hire, is slightly misleading, because tool hire, fine. I know what tool hire is. You know, you go down to Brandon Hire and as a consumer, effectively, you can hire a drill or a scaffold tower or whatever it is that they've got. Plant hire, which I tend to think of as something a bit larger. At the one end, you've got people who are, most of their business is earth moving contractors.
Yes. Yes.
Or they're groundworks contractors. And they've got lots of machinery, and if they've not got a job on, they say, "Oh, can you send a guy and a digger around to ours for a couple of weeks, please?" Yeah, we'll send you a guy and a digger, or a couple of few people and diggers. But they are essentially a contractor who also does. I mean, they might have started out as owner operating plant hire.
Yeah.
But as soon as your people are behind the controls digging that hole, the way I see it is you're digging that hole.
Yeah.
You're a hole digging contractor. Similarly, in the mobile crane hire industry, it's sort of clear and sort of muddier, because under Lola, the lifting operations and lifting equipment regulations, whatever it is, Lola, 1988. Lola, anyway. Are two forms of contract. There are two business models. One is you are a lifting contractor, where you are an end user, someone who wants something lifting up, will ring you up and say, "We want to subcontract to you a job of lifting something. You take on all the risk, you plan the risk, and you are a lifting contractor." And the other form of business is what's called straight crane hire, where someone rings up and says, "Can I borrow a crane, please? I need to lift something." And exactly the same thing happens. Your crane driver drives the crane from the depot down to the place that something needs lifting. The crane driver is exactly the same. He's not going to let the customer get behind the controls.
No.
Whether it's Ainsco, Bronzeshield, or whoever it is, it's the crane company's person operating the crane and executing the lift. Contractually, the only difference is where the risk lies, who supplies the lift plan, the appointed person, and all that stuff. So it's an allocation of risk. But to my mind, crane hire should not be allowed to exist. I think with machinery like mobile cranes, the risk should always be left where it belongs, which is with the people who know the machine.
Yeah.
The difficulty, of course, is that they don't know what the ground conditions are, and it's the client who knows the ground conditions, and that's why there's separation, because the ground condition is basically one of the biggest risks involved in a mobile crane lift. So there is a complication there, but essentially, to my mind, a mobile crane hire company is not a plant hire company. And if you look at the big end, like Mammoet and Sarens, for example, the big Dutch and Belgian companies,
they would never
say, "Oh yeah, we're in crane hire." Well, there might be a little bit in Belgium and the Netherlands. They might be sending out 20-ton cranes doing taxi crane service. But essentially, they are doing multi-million pound jobs in refinery change-outs or something, and big lifts. So anyway, going back to this super deduction... Yeah, if you're in whatever sort of plant hiring you're in, if you're buying the machinery, you should be entitled to, I think, the deduction, the tax rebate. If you're a member of the Civil Engineering Contractors Association and you choose not to buy your own machinery, as is the trend, I mean, they used to in the olden days, they all used to have their own machinery. But no, and I read that the current figure of how much plant machinery in the UK is bought for bare hire is about 70%.
Mm.
So only 30% of construction machinery being bought in the UK this year is going to qualify for this tax relief announced by Rishi Sunak.
Well, maybe Rishi Sunak knows that. Maybe Rishi Sunak knows that. That's why he wanted to exclude plant hire.
Well, no, I think the intention was valid. I think he wants fleets to get green and he wants money to be spent.
Yeah.
So, but we're running out of time. It only runs till next April, so it's all kind of a bit academic anyway, no?
Does it? Is it until next April? I thought it was 2023. I have to read the lowdown on super deductions again.
I thought it was just a 12-month thing.
They're available where the contract for the purchase was signed after the 3rd of March 2021 and the expenditure incurred between the 1st of April 2021 and the 31st of March 2023.
Okay. My apologies, listeners. Once again, Taylor is right, Bishop is wrong.
Right. Well, glad we got that off our chests.
We've sorted that one out. Problem solved.
Okay then. Well, is that it for that for this week?
It is. It is. And next week, I know what we're going to talk about. We're going to be talking about the magazine, the Top 100.
We are indeed.
List of ranking of the top 100 construction contractors in the UK.
Yes.
So join us next week, folks, for that one. But for this week, thank you very much for listening. Especially thank you to our special guest Richard Waterhouse from NBS. From David and I, cheerio.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.